Hello and welcome. Thank you for tuning into the best in paranormal talk radio. I'm Dave, that's Tim, and this is Darkness Radio. Today, Tim, we're going to go from a place of darkness where all things that bump in the night, that terrorize us from underneath our bed, are put away into a nice little tidy closet, which I've never actually seen in my house with eight children, Tim. I've never seen a tidy closet.
I don't doubt that.
It would be a miracle. Yeah. A miracle, Tim, if I had a tidy closet in this house.
I bet.
Today we're going to lighten it up. We're going to have some fun. We're going to talk about a different aspect of the supernatural and the paranormal. There's a new book out called The Miracle Collectors, Uncovering Stories of Wonder, Joy, and Mystery. That's right in our wheelhouse. So I'm going to also encourage listeners, because we can't get enough of these. I love miracle stories. If you've got your own miracle stories, when we ask for you to submit your own tales that we share on the show every Wednesday, I know some of you feel intimidated because you're like, boy, I haven't had anything scary happen to me, or I've never been eaten by a demon or attacked by a Sasquatch. It doesn't have to be those kind of stories.
No.
We love miracles.
Mm-hmm.
We love angel encounters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the rest are cool too, but don't feel pigeonholed. So if you've had a true miracle in your life, and it doesn't have to be literally God, you know, standing before you handing out loaves and fishes miracle, but if you've had something really remarkable that you deem to be a miracle, email me your story, dave@darknessradio.com, and we will discuss it on an upcoming episode of this program.
And you know what, Dave? I got to admit, I'm kind of partial to the good stories and the miracle stories. I've had some pretty fortunate stuff happen in my life and some things I can't explain that have kept me here on this planet. So I'm kind of partial to the miracle stories.
Tim, listen, I thank you. I know you're referring to finding me and becoming friends with me, but that's not a miracle.
No, that,
we were
that,
just
that
drunk
wasn't...
and at the same party and in an experimental phase of our life.
I wasn't really going to bring that up. That's kind of embarrassing, but I was talking about other stuff. But hey, if you want to throw that in, buddy, you throw that old little ego story in and...
Stop it.
It wasn't as big as you think, but hey, you know, I'll give you a few inches on it if you want.
We've got cool stories to share today, and joining us are the authors of this new book, Joan Louise Hill and Katie Mann. Thank you, ladies, for joining us today to share some insights into this book and miracles.
Thank you, Dave and Tim. Thanks for having us.
It's our pleasure. This is interesting. Again, you know, everybody always, this sounds like a Christmas book. Why isn't this book coming out at Christmas? Miracles happen around us all the time. It shouldn't just be pigeonholed to one holiday, right? April 8th is as good as December 25th when it comes to talking about remarkable stories and stories of hope and miracles. I'd like to know from both of you, and Katie, why don't we start off with you? Why miracles? What inspired your desire to explore this a little deeper?
Well, it's funny, you know, it's not exactly the career you dream about as a kid. Never thought that it would happen to me, but I had been haunted by an experience that I had all of my adult life that some people called a miracle, and I eventually looked for a spiritual explanation because nothing else seemed to satisfy what had occurred. And one day I was having coffee. We were, you know, this was 20 years ago, young moms. And I discovered that my two friends also had these extraordinary stories and, you know, were Jesuit educated Catholics who sort of wondered what really is a miracle? What does that mean? And is that in fact what happened to us? And so we wrote our first book, the three of us wrote a book called The Miracle Chase, and it really went through the research and, you know, scientists, philosophers, theologians over a couple thousand years and what they had to say on the subject. We really learned that miracles, it turns out, can't really be looked at arm's length, that they really are personal. Certainly our experiences were personal. And as we traveled around the country for book number one, we started every talk by sharing our stories. And you were just talking at the beginning of this show about asking people to share their own stories. We found that in sharing ours, people came out of the woodwork to share these stories. And, you know, over the years, we became the story keepers, and the Miracle Collectors was born. So that's kind of a short version of what happened.
All right. And in kind of diving into that, Joan, what about this was something that attracted you and made you want to understand it and share these stories as well?
Well, I think there's a couple of things. We talk about, you know, with miracles, and we, as Katie said, we sort of had this arm's length trying to figure out what had happened to us and how this happened. And we really figured out, you know, Katie, in her story, which I'm sure she'll tell you in a bit, was really this thunderbolt kind of experience, thunderbolt miracles, you know, the parting of the Red Sea, resurrection, you know, Muhammad escaping. But we also determined that there was a whole continuum of miracles from these thunderbolts down to, you know, waves of grace that occur, coincidences that occur, eerie coincidences that occur. And that was sort of the situation in my life where we had this series of coincidences that conspired to save the life of my 13-year-old son at the time. And we were kind of going through this in real time, trying to figure out, you know, I was just delighted. And my friends really needed to talk to me about these waves of grace that occurred. And so one of the things that we found when we talked to other people was often it takes someone else to help you recognize that there's been a miracle in your life. Sometimes it's really hard to, you know, do you deserve a miracle? Are you, you know, religious enough, this enough, that? You know, we weren't poster children for spirituality or religion, but we decided we really needed to understand more. And as we understood more and we went out and talked to people, it was as if we gave them permission and a vocabulary to talk about something that, you know, heretofore was sort of on the don't ask, don't tell list. You know, these things that had been kind of filed away in their minds and they didn't quite know what to do with. So we really talk about miracles as being, you know, very personal to people. You know, we believe that miracles happen in the lives of everyone. And, you know, we try through the Miracle Collectors to, you know, offer a path to help people find the miracles in their own lives.
I love that. What do you call it? Waves of grace. Is that what you said?
Waves of grace.
Man, if that doesn't sound like an awesome band name, Tim, I don't know what I've ever heard. Waves of Grace. What a great line.
That's a 90s rock band, I believe. Waves of Grace. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, they came out right after Extreme, wasn't it?
I think so, yeah, yeah. They were very much new rock, kind of that, yeah. Lots of mellow guitar, yeah.
For the record, guys, there is a Miracle Collectors Spotify playlist. So
nice.
Enjoy. Very cool.
Well, Joan, you know, we'll get to Katie in a few moments, but would you share with us what are you now defining a miracle? Again, I loved what you said, that sometimes we have to be shown a miracle. We need somebody to give us an outside perspective. You know, when my mom passed away 5 years ago, I was very angry. I was enraged at God for cheating my mom I was in a bad place, and I had to go up and give the eulogy. And it would have gone horribly, horribly wrong, except for the fact that Tim came over to me and said, "What's wrong?" And, you know, obviously, aside from the loss of my mom, I told him. And he said, "D, you got to look at this a different way, man." And it was so eye-opening to me that in this moment of rage and anger, and what I said was, My mom died. She spent her life in servitude to other people as a nurse. She was finally retiring. She could travel the world with my dad. They could go do these things and have this remarkable life. And Tim had to stand me back and remind me, "Dave, you know, since you moved out, your parents have traveled every year multiple times. They've seen the world. Your mom died doing the job she loved doing as a nurse. She lived to serve and help mankind. She did the job she was brought here to do. She met the man of her dreams and spent her life with him. She had a child that she loved and was very proud of. She lived a very full, rich life. Just because it didn't go the length or the way you wanted, it doesn't mean that her life, you know, wasn't fulfilled the way it was." And it put me on a different mindset. And in a way, you know, not the bolt of lightning miracle, it was a miracle in that moment because Tim shifted my paradigm and allowed my eyes to be open to something better and more beautiful about my mom's life and being there for her, with her, and, you know, just everything about it. And it, to me, that was really eye-opening and gave a different perspective to why we need to re-examine certain things. And I've talked about this one example before on the air, but I still love it. And it, I don't know why it's so silly, but it chokes me up. When my son was very young, Cliff, we were driving from Minnesota to Illinois to visit my parents. And we were talking about miracles and what is a miracle, Dad? And what does it mean to be a miracle? And I said, miracles happen around us every day. You just have to look for them. You have to know and sometimes accept things that seem mundane. And he said, well, I want a miracle, Dad. And I said, okay. So I called out and I said, all right, God, I want, you know, let's show my son a miracle. Let's give him a miracle. And a few minutes later, we cross this ridge. We go over the top of this road and down, and there is a miracle. And I pull the car over to the side of the road and I go, there you go, Cliff. And he looks at me and he's like, what, Dad? And I said, there's a miracle. And he just was completely perplexed. He goes, what are you talking about? And I said, look, come on. And we got out of the car and we walked out. And I said, here's a miracle. You asked for something extraordinary. And he said, yeah. And I go, you don't think it's extraordinary that moments after we ask for a miracle, we come upon a 7-foot sunflower jutting up out of the middle of a road? This is a highway. And there it is, a 7-foot tall sunflower. And he just kind of looked at me and I said, for a bird to have dropped a sunflower seed at the exact angle of incident that it would go into that crack, just the right amount of rain, just the right amount of dirt, just the right amount of sunshine. And at this time on the side of a very busy road, you mean to tell me this flower was able to grow to the, you know, 7 feet tall? I said, that's a miracle. And that we asked for it and we got it. That's a miracle. And it kind of, once he saw that, he was like, that's really cool. And I said, do you see any other sunflowers? Nope. Do you see any other flowers? Nope. But right here in this small crack in the road is this giant, beautiful, gorgeous flower that's here for us to see. And of course, he looked at me and said, great, let's take it. And I said, no, let's leave it for other people to enjoy. And it was just, to me, that was a moment. It wasn't my life was saved or an angel flew in front of the car to keep me from, you know, hitting a deer or anything like that that people want from Hollywood eyes. But it made its point. It's how you look at things, in my estimation, is how you perceive what miracles can or cannot be.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
So we talk a lot about that in terms of changing our perspective, and your friends, your family help you do that in terms of changing your perspective. But you also hit on something very important, Dave, which, you know, is really our second part of the book really talks about, which is, you know, Tim came to your aid at a time that you needed him. And sharing these miracle moments, sharing these miracle experiences really deepens a connection. You know, you can joke about it and all of that, but it does. You know, it takes us away from our little finger pressing and our digital technology and makes us connect on this, you know, soul to soul and, you know, the vulnerability to vulnerability. And, you know, that's what allows us to think about things, to do this jump shift. And we saw that time and time again with the miracle stories that we heard. And there's about, you know, over 50 stories in the book, the different things. Some of them are signs, people asking for a sign and getting them. We've got some great stories about that. But you are so correct, you know, ask for what you need. And then miracles as signs, really, you know, paying attention to what the sign is.
Right. But do you think that some people are deflected because they're waiting for that bolt of lightning from the sky and they may be overlooking the one flower jutting up out of the road 10 seconds after they ask for something to, you know, a sign that something miraculous is going on around us? Do you think that's why people miss the idea of what a miracle is?
I think that. I mean, we like to say, as many people have said before us, that miracles are really looking at the common in an uncommon way. Now, I will grant you that I don't think a 7-foot sunflower in the middle of a road after you've asked for a miracle is all that common. But it is along the same lines of what you're saying, that if people understand that miracles really are on this continuum, where at one end you've got big, bold, biblical in proportion type miracles, but at the other end you have personal signs that you come across, they are in the eye of the beholder. And another aspect, I think, of miracles, which you've touched on in one way or another, Dave, so far, is that they're also a reminder that we're not alone.
That's true, right? That there is something incredibly powerful and something, whether you want to refer to it as God or universe or energy or the cosmos or the hyperintelligence, there is something beyond just who we are as these fragile little humans.
Well, I think it's that. I mean, certainly when I said, you know, we're not alone, absolutely, about a higher power, but also that we're connected to each other, that understanding that miracles are something that are available to all of us, and that it is a place where we can find common ground, which today is more important than ever. You know, we have had the collective experience of the pandemic, but we're also living in a very polarized time politically. And that has made us feel maybe more divided than in fact we are. So I think miracles also connect us and make us not feel as alone in that way as well.
Joan, what was a miracle that occurred in your life that helped you shape and understand what miracles are and what they mean to you?
Well, I think, as I mentioned, you know, our son had this experience. He basically had a cardiac, a heart condition, a congenital abnormality in his heart, which went undetected until he was 13 years old. And he was a super athlete and had an incident of chest pain. And there was a whole series of coincidences that occurred. When we took him to the doctor and they figured out finally what it was, which was not easy to figure out, they had never before seen this condition in a person who was alive. They only saw it on people who dropped dead suddenly. And then they go, oh, yeah, it's this. And so we had this whole series of coincidences that put us in the right place with the right people at the right time to figure out how to, you know, resolve his problem. And he was a super athlete at the time. And basically what happened was he's in surgery. You know, no parent wants to be in a hospital waiting room while your child is undergoing an 8-hour surgery. The surgeon had told us he really didn't think he could do the surgery he wanted to do, which would have been a lifetime fix. He was going to have to bypass his heart, and he would have to then have every, you know, 10 to 15 years, another open heart procedure, which, again, no parent wants to hear. And my husband and I were sitting in the back of the waiting room, as far away from the television as we could get, Jerry Springer on the TV. I got a page to go to the phone. I went up to the phone. I got the nurse said, you know, calling from the operating room, your son's doing all right, but this is the most dangerous part of the operation. I said, geez, thanks a lot. I turned because I heard my name, my maiden name, Louise, being called. So I went, you know, Louise, Louise, and I sort of turned to pay attention to who was calling me. And the television station had changed. Jerry Springer was no longer on the television. The song of Bernadette, which had basically been, you know, won the Academy Award back in the mid-40s, was suddenly on the television. Now, Bernadette is the young woman who, at 13, founded the, you know, healing shrine at Lourdes, France, which, as we know, is still a great shrine today that calls millions of pilgrims each year. And everybody in the waiting room was like, what happened? Nobody changed the station. What is this? I go, oh, my God, this is my favorite, you know, movie from when I was a kid. It's Bernadette, you know, and went through the whole thing. And as parents, went out one by one as their own children's surgeries were completed. I was left by myself watching this television show. And as the credits rolled, the surgeon came in and he said, you know, Mrs. Hill, I was able to do the surgery that I wanted to do. Your son will be good for the rest of his life. I was able to fix that thing. So I felt like I had been, you know, hit with the 2x4 upside the head, if you will, of this feeling of peace that came over me instead of being, you know, complete wackadoodle in the waiting room. And Katie and I really talk about the ripple effect of a miracle quite a bit in terms of, you know, it's important to recognize what happens when it happens, but it also is important to see where the ripple goes. And I will tell you, my son is now an emergency physician on the front lines of COVID for last year in Chicago, you know, rippling his way forward for others. So that was sort of my introduction. And that was all going on during the time that we started thinking about this miracle, you know, doing this investigation on miracles. And then Katie started with her story. And I will let Katie tell you that one.
All right. Thank you. Katie, you have the floor. And boy, this ties into both of our programs, Darkness Radio and True Crime Tuesday, in a very unique way. Please tell us what happened to you.
Well, as I had referenced earlier, I had been haunted by an experience that I'd had when I was 19 years old. It was the summer of 1975. And I grew up in the Bay Area, the San Francisco Bay Area, and I had a job in San Francisco near Union Square that summer. It was the summer after my freshman year in college. And I had very set hours. I checked in at 7 a.m. and I was finished at 3 p.m. And in the San Francisco Bay Area, if you live in Marin County, one of the options to get home is by ferry boat. And so I always caught the earliest ferry, which was at 4 o'clock. But that meant that I had an hour or so to sort of kill before I needed to get to the ferry station. And this particular afternoon, I was standing in front of an old iconic San Francisco store called iMagnon. And if you lived in the Bay Area, it was, you know, getting one of the boxes from iMagnon at Christmas time or your birthday was just such a treat. And I loved that store. So there I was staring in the windows when a very clean cut man approached me. He was maybe 30 years old. And he said, I'm a stranger in town. I need some help. I've had eye surgery and I need to look up my best friend's parents in the phone book. So I need somebody to do the eye work for me. Can you help me out? And, you know, my first thought was, having grown up in a pretty sheltered environment, not being particularly street smart. But my first response was, don't take candy from a stranger, you know, get out of the situation kind of thing. And so I said, no, I'm sorry, I can't help you. And I went to the crosswalk and I was waiting for the light to change. He followed me. The light changes and he repeats his story. He was so persistent, very friendly. Finally, he says, you know, I'm staying at the Hyatt up the street. Now, the Hyatt was a block away. He said, won't you please help me out? Well, now I'm thinking, okay, I've got the time. Be a good Samaritan. So I said, sure, you know, I'll help you. So we walk to the Hyatt, which is built on a hill. And as I recall, we went into the building, a floor below the lobby. And sure enough, as I had thought, you know, there's going to be plenty of people around. So what could be the harm? And we got into an elevator to go up to the lobby. And when we got there, all the people that were in the elevator with us got out. The man and I were sort of standing in the back of the elevator. And it was right then where you, like, you know, if you had all the information in the world, I would have run. But I just stood there. I was embarrassed. I didn't know what to do. And the door closes. And I realize that he's pressed the mezzanine. And I tell myself, okay, the mezzanine's going to be crowded with people. So the elevator doors open. We get out. It's a completely deserted floor. We walk down a long hallway. We make a left-hand turn into a long conference room. And sure enough, in the back of the conference room there's a payphone and there's a phone book on a metal shelf below it. So I go back there and start looking for a brown family that lives on Marina Boulevard. And I'm facing this wall, and this man is standing somewhere behind me, you know, close behind me. And I start looking down these columns of browns, trying to find a brown that lives on Marina Boulevard. And maybe a minute goes by, and all of a sudden, this is the only way I can describe it. It was as if a cloud or a wave of absolute terror came over me. And it's not like I went down a checklist. It was this instantaneous recognition that there was no patch on his eye. He didn't know the first names of his best friend's parents. And in those days, that's how you would look them up if you were looking for a common name. And I was looking for a needle in a haystack, and I realized that. And here I was in this deserted room with a stranger that nobody knew I was there, and what I'd been taught my entire life not to do. And I turned around. And this man's entire face had changed. His eyes had gotten dark, and he knew that I knew, and that is exactly what he was waiting for. I mean, there was just no question. And just as he makes a movement toward me, a bellman walks in the room. He looks right at me. He says, "Don't you think you should be going now?" I walk out of the room with the bellman down the hallway. The elevator doors are open. The man doesn't follow. We go down into the lobby. I get out. I'm completely shell-shocked. But after a few seconds, I kind of get my wits about me. I think I should thank this man. And I look to my right and my left and ahead, and he's nowhere to be found. So I go home that afternoon, and I tell my mom, my dear Irish Catholic mother, may she rest in peace, who instantly says to me, "Oh my God, Katie, the bellman was an angel." Well, at the time, I thought, seriously, are we going to go through this again? I mean, it just wasn't where my head was. It wasn't how I thought. I kind of left the religion thing behind. And so I kept the story close. I mean, maybe I told my siblings, a handful of friends over the years, including my eventual husband. But the story was not one that I was comfortable telling, and I honestly didn't know what to do with it. I kept trying to tell myself that, you know, that maybe the man really didn't mean to harm me or, you know, whatever. But what the bellman said to me, that didn't make sense, and I could never get that out of my head. But I wasn't really looking for a spiritual explanation. And, you know, once or twice a year, I'd have a nightmare, and this man's face would literally be in my head, and I would wake up with my heart pounding. And so 15 years go by, and one night I'm in bed reading the morning newspaper, and my husband, because that's what you do when you have two toddlers and you both work full time. And my husband hands me the newspaper and said, "Oh my God, Katie, I think this is your guy." And there on the front cover is a photograph of Ted Bundy, who had been put to death the day before in the state of Florida. And the article recounted how, you know, his victims were between the ages of 19 and 21. They were 5'6 or 5'7. Their hair was parted in the middle, you know, down to their waist, blonde or brown. He feigned injury to lure his victims. He was a frequent visitor to San Francisco in the mid-1970s when he was at the height of his murder spree. And it was like the final puzzle piece to this experience, and it had a profound effect on me, and it sort of gave me the initial real push to look for a much more spiritual explanation, which I eventually came to embrace.
So I need to know, I mean, when you get that initial hit of, oh my God, this is the guy, this is the story. I mean, you're hearing about it at the time he's put to death. You weren't familiar with the national news grabbing headlines of Bundy's first couple of arrests and stories. That just kind of escaped you, or you just never really put two and two together?
I never put two and two together. I honestly don't remember ever seeing Ted Bundy's face anywhere. I certainly had heard about him, or maybe I'd seen him from a far profile or something like that. I never put two and two together. It wasn't until his, you know, mugshot, close-up face was on the front cover of that newspaper. And I had never really listened to the details, you know, of the profile of his victims, of the way that he always feigned injury, you know, I just had never listened to any of it. And so this was like the telephone call from God, literally, that just said, you know, you might want to rethink, you know, your whole complacency thing, because it seems to me the initial experience didn't quite kick you into overdrive. So how about this? You know, for my trump card.
That's crazy. That is, now, do you mind if we reel back for a second into your story? Only because, again, we've kind of covered
elements. No, of course.
We've covered elements of this. You said you're there, you turn around, and you look into this man's face. And you said his eyes had gotten dark. Can you explain that to our listeners? What exactly do you mean by that?
Well, until really recently, because with the publication of the book, I made it a point to never really research Ted Bundy or watch any of the movies or the documentaries or anything like that. Because frankly, it makes the hair on the back of my neck go up. But I had always said this thing about his eyes, you know, got dark. And I thought, that is just such a weird thing to say. And that's just such a weird thing that was my experience. But that was my experience and what I had already always said. Well, a couple of years ago, there was a documentary that came out that I think Netflix did on Ted Bundy. And I had friends who called and said, are you going to watch it? I said, you know, no. But I thought, I'm just going to listen to the trailer. You know, I'm just going to, you know, put my big toe in the water and just listen to the trailer. And in the trailer, they interview another survivor. And she said, his eyes got dark. And I was blown away. I couldn't believe it. And then I was reading an article recently that said the same thing, this odd thing about him, and that it's possible that that when he was working himself up into this rage, that his eyes dilated, that his eyes, you know, just literally got black, you know. Yeah, and then, of course, I've heard other things about evil. Trust me, either one fits.
Well, that's why I wanted to play that angle on it, because it is so terrifying, the concept of what exactly were you in close proximity to? Because, you know, again, you're right. In that trailer, they talk about his eyes turning black. We've heard other tales of this, and I know it's easy, folks, to discount and say, well, that's just, you know, they don't necessarily mean that specifically. It's like that, his eyes dilated, this, that, or the other. We actually have audio from, of all sources, one of our guests from True Crime Tuesday that talked about this very chilling element of Ted Bundy during one of the trials when one of the bodies was found. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll play that audio right now.
When you say the name serial killer, one name seems to come up the most when I chat with people. When you throw out that word, it almost seems magnetized to one man. Although there have been killers before him and many after him, there's one name that just seems to really draw people's attention and comes to the forefront of the mind. There is a guest that we've had on in the past. He's back with us today. He's worked and completed his third book in this trilogy regarding Ted Bundy. He's a writer of history and true crime stories. Kevin Sullivan is the author of around 12 books. He's a former investigative journalist for both print and online media, and he's recognized authority on serial sex killer Ted Bundy. He's here today to talk to us about his new book and about Ted Bundy.
There were some aspects of Ted Bundy's psychological makeup, even as a child, that were not right.
Here's something that really kind of intrigues me. Because, as you know, I do a paranormal radio show 5 days a week.
Sure.
If ever there was an opportunity to believe in a reincarnated spirit showing itself, to me, this sounds like it. When you're a 3 or 4 year old kid and you're looking at your aunt under the blankets and you're putting knives in compromising places, man, if that doesn't seem like an old soul that has reawakened in this new form and might, you know, in a supernatural or metaphysical way, explain how he could be almost two people at once. Was there more than one soul, one consciousness that lived inside Ted Bundy's body? And it's easy for us to say psychologically, is he a split personality or dissociative behavior?
Right.
But this seems to be above and beyond even the normal weirdness of a 3 or 4 year old. I mean, this is
bizarre. Well, and I never talk about what I'm about to tell you in my true crime books, but there's a lot of people that think, and I think so too, that for some reason, doors were open and demonic spirits got into Bundy when he was young, and that when he started embracing a lot of this stuff, they would energize it. So I do believe in that. And people that don't even believe in this stuff have talked about some of the supernatural, a couple times supernatural events happened that they witnessed when Bundy was sitting there. Stephen Michaud, who wrote along with Hugh Ainsworth, The Living Witness, and they did also a book of the transcripts of the tapes they made with Bundy called Conversations of a Killer. He mentions a situation where when Ted began to talk about a murder, he said he grabbed my my recorder, pulled it up to his face, and it's like he went into a trance. And then during this trance-like state, he said a white welt appeared on his face, and like a line drew across his face, and it was there. He said, I know this is going to sound weird, but I saw it myself. And he said, and during this trance-like state, when he was describing this murder, and apparently this happened more than once, that welt would be there just coming out of nowhere, and then it would disappear. After he was done, then he would kind of come back to himself. And then also there were some other people, not even related to these writers, who were sitting with Bundy on his defense team in Florida when the news was brought to them that they had located the body of Kimberly Leach, a 12-year-old girl that he had killed. And they said when Ted heard it along with them there, they said a strange smell started emanating from him. His body tone changed. And it's like he was changing, transforming right before them. And these guys don't know what that is. I do.
Terrifying stuff. Really, really bizarre. Again, that was featured on our True Crime Tuesday program a few years back. The Miracle Collectors is the book we're talking about right now. The authors, Joan Louise Hill and Katie Mann, are here with us. We have a link up for their book and a link to their website in today's program guide. So make sure that you go get the book. In this time of strife and upheaval and irritation and pandemic, we all need something to lift our spirits. And this is a great book. And it is available for those of you like myself that love a good audiobook. It's available in audiobook, Kindle, or hardcover. We've got a link up for the hardcover. If you go in there, it'll give you options for all three. So make sure you get the book, rate, and review it. We're going to take a quick break. We'll come back. We'll talk more about miracles when we return right here to Darkness Radio. Welcome back to the program. This is the best in paranormal talk radio. This is Darkness Radio. And no, we're not always talking about the creepy, the scary, the unusual, although that last miracle story was very unnerving. We love to share bright stories of miracles and wonder, and that's what this book is, uncovering stories of wonder, joy, and mystery, The Miracle Collectors. Our guests today, Joan Louise Hill, Katie Mahon. I've got to ask you, Joan, what did you think of that the first time Katie relayed that story to you?
Well, the joke is that as the two of us were sitting there listening to Katie's story, it is the only time in the 10 years that we wrote the first book together that we were ever silent. what can you say? We were speechless. And that doesn't often happen. So it is a remarkable story, but it reminds us, and you said this at the beginning, you know, there are miracles that are thunderbolts, and we certainly classify Katie's escape from Ted Bundy as one of those. And then there are miracles that are, you know, these series of coincidences, things that just are a miracle to you, the sunflower in the road, you know, and we heard many of those kinds of stories where, you know, someone asks for a sign and, you know, then they're aware enough and pay attention enough to see that sign. And that's what's really, very, very important to us, to have people, you know, begin to really become more aware of their own surroundings, their own internal and external surroundings, so that they can find the miracles in their own lives.
How do we ask for miracles? I know myself, I always feel guilty, but sometimes we need that uplifting bit. We need something to connect us and make us feel as, you know, that we're not alone. I know some of the miracles that have happened in my life have happened without fully asking for them. And some have come directly on the heels of wanting help. You know, I talk about one again, that this is for some, the skeptic, the cynic could easily dismiss. As I'm driving home one day, and, this was in the late 90s, I was going through a dark spell and feeling kind of despondent and out of sorts. And I had the radio on, as I often do, and I was just, it was background noise. I wasn't even paying attention to what was being played. And I just remember saying out loud, "All right, God, I need some kind of sign here because I'm feeling lost and I'm feeling alone." And it was as if somebody literally lifted their hands off my ears as the lyrics on the radio just got louder and it literally sounded like I was in a concert. And it was Cyndi Lauper's song, when all of a sudden, as I say, I need to know that I'm not alone, that there's, you know, I need a miracle, I need something. These lyrics, if you're lost and you look, then you will find me time after time. And it just they keep repeating those lines at that exact moment. Now, happenstance, sure. Serendipity, maybe. But it was really unnerving to me because, again, it felt like the scales had been pulled back from my ears and I could hear. And it was like I got this audio response immediately upon asking for that. So I look at those moments as my connection, my miracles, the little things that help make me feel better. But sometimes people feel unworthy to ask for them. What are your takes on that? And how, you know, should we be asking for them? And Joan, let's start with you.
Well, I think that, you know, the experience that you have is not an uncommon one. We were at a book talk, a woman kind of raised her hand and told us a story. And she was a very high profile professional in Southern California in a male dominated, career path. And she had three small children under five. And she was, you know, had told us this story. She was just at a point in her life where her marriage was suffering. Her life was, you know, discombobulation between the kids and trying to balance her very busy job. And one day she's driving down an LA freeway and the kids are, you know, squawking in the back seat as they will or want to do. And she just goes, "God, I can't take it. I need a sign. Tell me what to do. Please tell me what to do." And, you know, she knew that her job, her workplace had never allowed anyone to work part-time. So she was always afraid to bring that up. So she's going down the highway. She just, you know, puts up a prayer. "Please, God, please let me, you know, give me a sign. I need to know what to do." And just at that moment, she passes a huge billboard. And the billboard has a picture of Our Lady of Guadalupe, which is a, you know, special sort of devotion for Mexico. And it's advertising a Mexican beer. And it says, "Just ask," in big letters. She goes, okay, God, I didn't, you know, didn't mean a sign, but I'll take it. So she goes into work on Monday morning and she talks to her boss and she says, you know, I need to work part-time. I know you don't do this. He goes, nope, we've been waiting for you to ask. That's fine. You can go to part-time. So, you know, sometimes these signs are just that literal. And I think that we're afraid to say these things sometimes out loud because we're afraid of what people might think about us. Like, you know, will they think that we've lost our mind? But the point that we're trying to make with people is that, no, you know, these miracles are available to everyone if we ask. And we offer sort of this path to that through at the end of every chapter. We have something called the Take a Miracle Moment Challenge, which is basically a series of very practical, simple little exercises, questions, that you can ask yourself and jot down answers about how you might become more open to seeing these events in your own life. And, you know, we also really talk about this notion of a miracle. Sometimes we think about asking God to say yes to us, but sometimes we have to say yes to God, and sometimes we can be the miracle for someone else. And that's a really important thing that we've seen, and it's empowering, I think, to each of us. And, you know, we never really know what thing we do will really be the miracle in somebody else's life. But trying to, you know, go about our day and help where we can, sometimes it's just what somebody needs in their life. So we too can be, you know, miracles for others.
I like that. I like that fact. And a lot of times, like you said, and this is one thing that I try to do and reflect on when I'm in a bad place. And Tim, again, is responsible for this concept to me of sitting back and taking stock of life. And that, you know, sometimes, D, it's not just, you know, what's going on in the moment. Look at the bigger picture. And had we not done this, had you not been here, had you not said this, how would this have changed for other people? And sometimes, again, in reexamining our place, I will sit there, and it's not a pat on the back to myself, which is fine to do as well. We should give ourselves accolades, but it's an understanding that you've become an instrument for other people's life-changing moments. And we, I think one of the best compliments Tim and I get, you know, we're two goofballs that mentally are probably still stunted at 16 years old, who do a show with best friends to talk about things that fascinate us. And then we get these beautiful emails from people telling us how they no longer feel alone, or that we said something that day that brought them back from the brink of suicide or hurting somebody else. And those little moments, and Tim has been great at keeping me in check throughout my life and friendship with him now going on 30 some years, that, you know, this is what's going on. This is the thing we have to watch for. And you can see these threads of, boy, had we not done this, and had I not gone there and not stayed friends and not all of these people might not have met, all of these people might not have had this life. And you look at that, and it's cool to kind of get the overview of our lives are important, not just for ourselves, but for the trajectory that we might help others experience, and sharing those stories. And, you know, Tim and I have been very open on the show with our own struggles with anxiety, depression, and medical issues over the years. And every year or two, I'll post this story about my attempted suicide in high school. And I repost it because I always think, well, you know what? I don't want it to seem self-gratifying. Like, look, folks, but the reason I reposted is because the response I get is from so many people that needed to see that message again today. So the miracle that happened to me when I was 17 is still playing out. And when other people read it and feel that same connection I felt, you know, 40 years ago, this gives them the opportunity to maybe realize they're not alone. So it does still continue to have that kind of rollout effect on people. And that's a great moment. That's okay to feel all right for realizing you've been a part of helping to change other people for the better, and being a part of a miracle for somebody else.
I think you're 100% correct. And I think it's one of the things that keeps Katie and I, you know, on this miracle journey, is that so often people tell us that it's just what they need to hear, or it recalls a story from their past that, you know, helps them realize that they're important. I mean, and it's little things. It's very funny. We were doing a book talk one time, and after we were signing books, and a mother and daughter came up to me, and Sudha said, you know, we came here tonight because we were sort of looking for hope. We were looking for something. Mom is just back from being in the hospital. She had attempted suicide. How will I ever forgive her? How will we ever work this out and have forgiveness between you and understanding between us again? And it was so serendipitous. I had been at a author's event the week before. I had spoken to a woman who had just written a book on, she was a psychiatrist actually, who had written a book on her own mother's suicide and how one deals with it as a child. And I was like, okay, here's your card. Call this woman up. Because they said, how will we find somebody who will understand what we've been going through? So you just never know. And it can be very simple. And that's where we sort of say these experiences, these coincidences that, you know, maybe God's way of, being anonymous in our lives are very important. And showing up is a really important part of what we do. And you never know who and how people show up in your lives is going to really make a difference. But it keeps us getting up in the morning talking about miracles.
Right.
Well, I was going to, and just to add to that point, I mean, Dave, what you are talking about when you share what is a personal and traumatic experience, and the fact that you allow yourself that level of vulnerability and courage, frankly, to share that story. I mean, that is a perfect example of the ripple effect of a miracle that, as you said, has affected other people. And one of the things that we talk about in the Miracle Collectors a lot is this idea of being willing to share a story, because it does break down barriers the barriers that separate us. And just like you have found people, you know, your story resonates with them and helps them. It is a way that, I know we keep saying this, but there, we have so much in common, you know, and I think that's one of the things that Joan and I both really want to underscore, is that we're living in this polarized world in a challenging time, and yet we have so much in common if we'll simply share stories with each other that everyone can relate to, and offer up a level of vulnerability that allows us to understand this connection that we have.
Well, and I think that Katie's exactly right, and what she also mentioned, the word courage. And we talk about a notion that we present of miracle courage, and that miracle courage is sort of a theme that's woven throughout the book, because it takes practice. You know, you have to, Maya Angelou sort of said, you have to exercise courage like you would any other muscle. And telling a miracle story, sharing a part of your life, you know, stopping to help someone, you know, or falling and getting back up again, or, you know, the ability to tell your story really takes courage to be able to do that. And we've seen that time and time again. You know, one of my favorites was a woman who's about 5 foot tall who didn't want to tell her story sitting down like everyone else. She, like, stood, you know, up and kind of pushed back her shoulders and, I have a story and I'm going to tell you this and I've never told anyone before, kind of thing. And that takes courage. And I think that it is something that doesn't necessarily come naturally to everyone, but through exercise and, you know, by responding with this, what we call generosity of spirit towards each other. And as Katie said, you know, finding the commonalities with each other instead of only our differences, you know, we can each, again, find these miracles in our lives.
Well, let me
just one more.
Go ahead. No, please.
Well, I was just gonna say that you asked a question earlier about people feeling maybe that they're not worthy to ask for a miracle, and I just wanted to say that, you know, don't deny yourself a request that you didn't make. You know, I mean, particularly when you make a request of, you know, the universe or a higher power or God or however you want that your framework is. I think it's tough to say that you want to win the ball game, but when you make a request like the one that you made, when you're sort of in a really tough time and you need help. And that kind of a request, I really believe is met just about every time. And everyone, of course, is worthy to ask for help, because that's really what you're saying. Am I worthy to ask for help? And the answer is, of course, and as worthy as the next guy.
I like it. Again, folks, if you've got your own stories, share them with me. If you've, you know, I'd love your thoughts too of, do you ever feel like you're not worthy of asking in those low moments? We've been doing prayer and healing requests on this show since we started back in 2006, where we've mentioned it on air, we've mentioned it on social media. And with that said, let me just put one thing out, folks. If you want us to post prayer and healing requests, it has to be the actual person that's requesting or an immediate family member. I know it sounds weird in this day and age, but we've actually been threatened with lawsuits for posting prayer and healing requests in the past because the person that the prayer and healing request is going out for did not want their story public. So we have to have it directly from the person or an immediate family member so that our butts are protected as well in this day and age. You would think that there would be no repercussions for trying to do something nice, but some people haven't told everybody in their family or friends what is going on, and our outing it does not help. So please understand if we do hold off from posting your prayer and healing requests, you understand why, and I just wanted to put that out there. But Tim, in 15 years of doing this, we've had a lot of people come back to us because of the prayer and healing requests we put out there. But I know that you've got your own stories. And, you know, we talk a lot about the stuff that's influenced and occurred to me. But what are some of the miracles in your life that you can point to that that listeners may or may not be familiar with?
Well, I've talked quite a bit about the ones that have. I don't know if I've talked so much about... I'll talk about one specifically. I've talked about it a little bit before, but I haven't shared it with these ladies. And I had a I had a brush with sepsis. And sepsis is one of those deals where, you know, people say sepsis is these days, and it is one of those deals where people get out of sepsis a lot easier these days than they used to. Sepsis used to be a death sentence. When you had it, you were pretty much done. Nowadays you have a pretty good chance. It's like, more like 50 or 75, 25, 50, 50 that you will get through it. Mine was in the bloodstream, and, I was worse off than I think a lot of people know. When I had got into the emergency room, they were really afraid that it was pretty close to my heart. And at the time things weren't looking good. And I came, I'm trying not to get emotional here. I really did come within about 60 seconds of dying. In that time, I had two nurses working at me, and I had heard them calling for more help. I had one nurse working on my blood pressure, another working on my blood sugar, trying to keep me alive. And I had this wonderful Jamaican nurse who was feeding me this really terrible lemony paste and just screaming at me that she wasn't going to let me die today, which I'm forever grateful for. And I don't talk about this a lot because it
understandable.
Yeah.
But it's look, I mean, an amazing story that may help others realize, and again, connect you to the audience to realize that, you know, we all have these moments, but here you've got these two angels of mercy working diligently and telling you they're not going to let you go.
Yeah.
And they were there to be your Tim in this situation.
And they, you know, they work so diligently. And I remember the room fading away. I remember things going black, and I remember coming back again. And I remember them saying they lost me for a minute. But I remember them saying that I came back, and then I remember Dave 2 hours later asking me where the podcasts were, and that they needed to be uploaded.
That sounds like Joan and me.
Yeah. So he's like, yeah, we need them uploaded, man. We need them uploaded.
This is still business, miracle or not, Tim. We need stuff to get handled. So, that's amazing. You reflect back on that, Tim, the miracle of the right people in the right place at the right time doing all the right things. You at what point did it dawn on you this was really kind of a miracle in a moment that was the transcended just two nurses working on a patient?
It was the moment where I realized I'd gone, and that there was something that had kept me there. That I truly had no control. You realize at that point that you had no control. There was just a moment where it was beyond you. You know, you have this truly stupid notion that you're in control of everything on this earth. That the world revolves around you, that you get up in the morning and you can control every aspect of your life. And then you get in a situation like that and you just realize what a grain of sand you really are in this universe and how much you don't control.
I gave up the realization that the world revolves around me when I had children, because now I realize it just revolves around them, Tim. At least that's what they try to
do. I mean, just in that situation, you think, well, I can get through this because I've toughed through everything. I mean, I've been knocked down so many times and gotten back up that I just think, oh, it's just another thing I'll get through. And you really do believe in mind over matter in a lot of situations. The body's a wonderful thing. You can... You know, if you believe it, you can achieve it. It's almost like a quantum physics type of thing, you know. But in that situation, when you are laid low like that, when there is something that's greater than you, you almost can't overcome that. You know, there's going to be a situation someday, we're all going to be in it, where you can't overcome that final scenario. Right. And I thought that was my final scenario.
You bring up the mind over matter, but that's really kind of the hallmarks too, sometimes of a miracle. You weren't necessarily there, but it was the will of others and the will of God that you survived that moment. You know, when we did that prayer and healing request back in 2006 and we got reached out to from a friend saying, hey, I don't believe in this prayer and healing stuff, but I'm willing to give it a shot. Our good friend Cheryl, who's part of the Long Island Paranormal Investigation Team, is in the hospital. The priest is performing last rites. She had a massive asthma attack that has left her lifeless. Can you please put out a prayer and healing request? And we posted that back in the day of MySpace, believe it or not. Put it out, got a lot of a great response. And within, I think it was 24 to 48 hours, she was out of the hospital. We're still in contact with her 15 years later. And as a lifelong asthmatic, she has informed me she has hit the puffer a few times. But as a lifelong asthmatic, to go from constant tethering to the puffer and almost dying after these prayers were sent to her, unknowing to her, she was unconscious. She was gone for all intents and purposes. All of a sudden, she's back, and someone, something was heard, and a miracle was delivered. It's really pretty pretty astounding that sometimes, even when we're not aware of it, miracles happen in our lifetime.
Well, and I've been in situations where, you know, I've been in a hospital room at 3 o'clock in the morning when a doctor, the head of infectious diseases, has come in into a hospital and said, we're going to take your leg right here if it doesn't get better by, you know, in 3 hours, in 4 hours. And I've had no one to talk to but God. That's it. You know, I can't call anybody on the phone. I can't wake them up. And I have no one in my hospital room. You know, I mean, that's just,
wow.
That's, you know, I've been in those situations.
Yeah.
You know, and I've been in those desperate situations. That's been my life. And people say, well, you know, oh, you shouldn't just be so negative, or you shouldn't, you know, it's just, you know, oh, it's all in your head. You hear a lot of that stuff sometimes, but, you know, I've been in a lot of real life situations, Jack. That's my life. That's been my life. And there's times where you have to kind of, you know, give up and give to God. You know, that's what you do.
Well, ladies, let's talk about some of the other miracles that you cover. The book, again, The Miracle Collectors, Uncovering Stories of Wonder, Joy, and Mystery. Joan Louise Hill and Katie Mahon are guests today. Katie, what's one of your favorite books or stories from the book that you can share with us?
There's, like Joan said, there's probably over 50 stories in the book, and she shared one that is one of our favorites because it's short and sweet, and honestly, we love the fact that it's a literal sign. You know, we always talk about, oh, it's a sign. This was a literal sign, and it would really be wonderful if that's the way God communicated to us all the time. I would say one of the most interesting stories from the book, and I had an opportunity to interview this woman a couple of different times after she told the story for the Miracle Collectors book. But we were at a book signing in the Bay Area, and one of the things we talk about in the book, the very first section, and frankly, it sounds like you Dave and Tim are very well versed in this idea of awareness of what's around you and what's within you. We spend the first third of the book talking about becoming aware, perception and paradigm shifts and that sort of thing, which we talked, you know, hit on a little bit earlier. But anyway, we were sitting in there, and like we do at the end of every talk, does anybody have a question or anybody have a story? And just as our other friend who didn't write this second book with us, she did write the foreword for us. But anyway, she was about to, you know, fill in the blank. And I thought, you know what, I'm just going to let the pregnant pause hang in the air. So I kind of tapped her leg, like, let's just let it sit for a second longer than we're comfortable. And this woman piped in and said, I have a story that's a little bit like Katie's. Now, she was there with her 14-year-old daughter and her best friend, neither of whom had heard this story. She was recently out of college. She lived in the Washington, D.C. area, and she was looking for a job in film production. And she had two interviews, one on a Sunday evening, one on a Monday morning. And the one on Sunday evening, both her parents and her boyfriend, who would ultimately become her husband, gave her kind of a hard time, like, what a weird time to have an interview. And, you know, she is saying to herself, geez, you know, I just want to get a job, people, leave me alone. And so she neglected to mention either who the interview was with or where it was going to happen. She goes to a fairly deserted area of a business office complex on a Sunday evening at like 6 o'clock. And there was someone else who opened the door, but by the time this man starts to show her around, she realizes that this place is deserted. And when she had first walked into his office, she saw all these trophies and she thought, wow, you know, he's a big wig in the film, you know, he's won all these awards. Well, he proceeds to terrorize her for the next hour, and evidently in a very sexually overt way that she wasn't comfortable talking in front of her 14-year-old daughter, but it was terrifying. And she decided right away that she needed to play his game and tell him that, yes, she would obey him, and yes, she would do all these things, because she knew, she just kept looking for a way out, a way to escape. And eventually they end up back at his office where she realizes that the trophies that she saw on the bookcase were actually for martial arts and not for film. And she realizes the level of trouble that she's in when his phone rings. She doesn't answer it. He doesn't answer it. But his phone rings, you know, it stops ringing, and then it rings again. He doesn't answer it again. And finally it rings a third time, and he picks it up in exasperation. And it turns out that the person that's on the other line, she was able to hear them say Yellow Cat Productions, which is the place that she had the interview with the next morning. So she knew right then that that was her way out, that if she simply let that person know that she was haunted by the fact that nobody knew where she was.
Right.
Or who she was with. So she yells at the top of her lungs, "Hey, this is Rebecca. I have an interview at Yellow Cat Productions tomorrow." And the guy quickly gets off the phone, grabs her by her arm, and says, "If you tell anyone what happened today, and you don't, you know, you have to show up on Monday, or I will literally ruin your life." And he couches the whole thing initially by saying, "I've decided to let you go." He pushes her out the door. She runs so fast to her car that she loses her shoes. She gets home. Anyway, they ultimately arrest this man who had been a serial rapist in the Washington, D.C. area. He's convicted of his crimes, et cetera. The thing that was really interesting to me about talking to Rebecca subsequently is that she, like many of us, and something that I could completely relate to, she said that she felt somehow it was her fault. She was embarrassed by being so stupid, and she felt like it was her fault. And in sharing her story with us, she realized how important, how worthy, you know, getting back to your question, that she was, and that she needed to respect herself and the sacredness of herself, body and soul. And that ultimately the miracle was, of course, the coincidence of the phone call and who it was from. But as she said to us, it was also the fact that in that moment of lengthy terror, I was able to have the wherewithal to empower myself to do this reverse psychology on this guy, which saved me. He held all the power, and yet I found a way to hold him off long enough to get out of there. And that, to her, was the real miracle. And I think that what I love about Rebecca's story is that it's not as black and white. It's not, yes, you could just say, "Oh, wow, that's incredible about that phone call." But she really saw this metamorphosis of herself. And so I actually learned a lot from her and her story.
Very cool. You know, and it is, it's a miracle in a way that, again, isn't it interesting how subjective miracle is and what people will perceive miracles to be, you know, what, the, you know, how this clarity, this understanding at that moment saved her life and made a change, something that she maybe didn't understand she was capable of or whatever, but she realized that it seemed like it was something beyond who she was in that moment.
Exactly. Exactly.
Joan, what's one of your favorite tales from the book?
Well, you know, I think that I love the story that Katie just shared with you, but we had, again, such very simple tales, simple things that happened. And, you know, to Tim's story, so many of the stories we heard were really emotional. You know, we've got, even since we've been doing some radio things, people have called and told us their stories, and you do get this emotional, you know, release from realizing, you know, how close one comes to disaster and, you know, how you're saved. So I think that one of my stories that I really like, because it you know, I see this epiphany almost occur in someone's eyes. I was at a book club and a woman, you know, people were kind of, we were talking about our first book and we were talking about, you know, miracles, and the discussion went on. And she kind of raised her hand and she said, well, I have a story. I don't think it's a miracle, but, you know, I have a story. And she said, you know, I was in London and I was going back to New York, and I kind of felt like I wanted another cup of coffee and I maybe wanted a different book. And so I went up to the desk. This is in the days of yore. I went up to the desk and I said, geez, is there a different plane that I could take? And the person at the desk said, yes, there's another plane to New York leaving in a half hour. And she goes, okay, great. I'll take that. And off she goes to the bookstore. So she's telling the story. And she said, the flight I didn't get on was Pan Am Flight 103 that blew up over Lockerbie, Scotland. And she said to her group, there was this big collective, gasp. And she said, do you think that there's anything to that? And all of a sudden, in seeing the reaction of her book group friends, she got this sense of, yes, there is something to that. And yes, your life is way more important than you ever gave it credit for being. And she saw that. And so watching someone realize, and we've talked about this before, that they're not alone. Not only are they not alone in the big alone, you know, with this higher power, but they're not alone to each other, and that people are important to each other. And, you know, that's why that Jamaican nurse was not going to let you die that day. You know, you were important to her. And, you know, we've seen this time and time again. And I love seeing stories, and it comes through in Rebecca's story as well, realizing that, you know, their life is important, and it's important, you know, to their family, to their friends, to themselves. And I think that, you know, people need to realize it's, you know, not to hide their light, but they are worthy. And I think that's empowering. So if we can help people, you know, recognize and find these miracles in their lives, then I think it is all to the good.
I'd love if you guys don't mind. Are there any of these miracles that are kind of funny in nature? You know, that overall tell kind of a fun, weird story or something that jumps out at you that would be maybe a different version of a miracle story that people hadn't heard before.
Well, Katie knows I love the story of a friend of mine who was married for 47 years before her husband passed away. And every year for 47 years, she got a dozen long-stemmed yellow roses delivered to her door. And so on the first anniversary after her husband's death, she's sitting, you know, at 7:30 in the morning in her jammies having her coffee, and her doorbell rings. So she lives on a dead-end cul-de-sac, and she thinks somebody must be in trouble. So she goes to the door to answer it, and there's a delivery man with a dozen long-stemmed yellow roses at the door. And she goes, oh, you know, she smiles and takes the roses and brings them in the house, and, you know, sipping her coffee, looking at the roses and thinking how lucky she is to have children who remembered her and all of this. And so after a little bit, she opens the card that came with the roses, and she doesn't recognize the name at all. She goes, who's this? And then she looks at the address on the little card. It's not to her. It's not to her part of town. So she calls the florist shop that's not open and leaves a message saying that she got these, you know, dozen long stem yellow roses, and, you know, she's not the intended addressee, and she doesn't know the people on the card. And they call her back and they say, yeah, I don't know how that happened or what mistake that was, but we're going to come and pick them up. And, you know, she knew where they were from.
Right.
And, you know,
so I love the miracle for her is the fact that some other poor woman never got her flowers or wasn't going to get her flowers.
No, so, she got them because the florist came to pick them up and brought them to the next person. But the fact that, you know, she really did feel connected to something, you know, right, beyond what she could see. And I think that that's really important for all of us to remember that, you know, we sort of say there's no atheists in foxholes. I think that, you know, when you're alone in the hospital room at 2 a.m. talking to God, you sort of feel that way, or talking to anyone. And I think that, you know, for me, that's a really emblematic story of, you know, we don't know what we don't know. So why not go with it?
I love it. I'm with you. Katie, what's one of your more fun, uplifting, weird stories from the book?
Well, I would say, and, you know, actually, this is pretty funny. So this happened to us all the time writing the book. So it's sort of like the miracles within the miracles. Like we would need something, or we would even get something that we didn't even know that we needed. But one of the chapters in the book is called It's a Wonderful Life, as in F-U-L-L. But it was a play on words from one of our favorite Christmas movies, It's a Wonderful Life. And as we were writing this chapter, we thought that the connection to the movie, It's a Wonderful Life, would begin and end with our sort of, you know, pithy, you know, right, chapter title. And then one day, Joan, literally, we are writing this chapter. And Joan runs into, Joan, you might have to, I might butcher these details, but anyway, she runs into an old friend, daughter, who she knew quite well, and who had a miracle baby, that she had been told that she couldn't get pregnant. She'd tried for a really long time, that if she did get pregnant, she wouldn't be able to carry the baby to term. They tried one more time, I think through IVF or something, and she did conceive, and she did have this miracle baby. But while she was pregnant, she kept praying to the fictional angel Clarence, who was anybody that knows the movie, It's a Wonderful Life. So right, she's praying to Clarence through this entire pregnancy. And of course, it's a boy, and they shortened his name to Clark. But she said, I prayed to Clarence, you know, the fictional angel from It's a Wonderful Life. And so, of course, we had to put that story in the book and in that chapter.
I love it. I love it. What a funny story, right? Of all the names to come up with, Clarence is the one angel she calls out to. But, you know, I guess the message was clear. She was calling for help from a higher power, whatever the name, yes, of the angel is that you want to give, right?
That's exactly right. You know,
oh,
and I think
Joseph.
That,
oh, Joseph, right?
exactly. And I think that's, you know, if we found out anything, it's that God really doesn't care what you call him or her. Anyway.
What do you say, and I'd like both of you to kind of weigh in on this. If you don't, we'll start off with you, Joan. What do you say to people that feel disconnected? And they say, but where's my miracle? You know, there's the famous footage from, and I can't remember her name. I want to say Elizabeth Smart, but I'm not sure if that's the right one. It was one of the little girls who had gone missing and then was found years later alive. And her father was up on the stage, and off to his side was one of the other fathers of a famous missing girl. And he's made of God heard our prayers and she's still alive. And the other father, you know, responded with, well, why didn't God hear my prayers? How do we respond to people that are looking for miracles and are not seeing them or are not having them in their lifetime? Joan, what do you say to people like that?
Well, I think it's a really hard question. It really is. But I think that it goes back to your perspective. And our third author of our first book, her daughter had been shaken brutally by the babysitter. And instead of, and so this 6-month-old became blinded. And every day her grandfather went to church, and every day he prayed that his granddaughter would regain her sight. And so sometimes, but his granddaughter never did regain her sight. But what she did gain was she did go to Stanford. She did get a PhD. She is a gainfully employed person, happy person, living her life. And so we have to change our perspective a little bit sometimes to look at maybe the miracle we get isn't the miracle we asked for. And I think that, you know, there are certainly people, and I'll let Katie answer about the, you know, those that are saved versus those that are not. But I think that, you know, we have to really look at, you know, I think we're hardwired to find the positive. And I think that's, you know, that's an important piece. We know this. I mean, we've all been watching YouTube videos and various things through this pandemic time to help us, you know, but there is evil in the world. There's no two ways about it. There's no doubt about it. But just because there's evil in the world, you know, does not require that we become consumed by it and we lose our ability to find the good in the world and the joy in the world and the positive things that are available to us. So I'll turn it to Katie because I know she's got a wonderful response.
Well, it's, you know, the thing is, like Joan said, it's not just a hard question. I think it's the hardest question when you talk about miracles. And I think you're talking about the father of polyclass, who was standing with Elizabeth Smart's father. And while I do love the example that Joan gave about our friend Meb's daughter, I have to tell you, as a parent, having one of your children brutally kidnapped and murdered is, you know, all bets are off. I mean, I don't know how you breathe in and out after that.
No.
So it's a tragedy of such gargantuan proportions. It's very, very hard to be, I've always felt this way. It's very hard to be a cheerleader for your own saved life when Ted Bundy, you know, brutally murdered 30 young women. So it's a question that really bothers me and has haunted me. And I wish I had a better answer than, you know, I think any kind of faith requires that you take a leap. But I will say this. I read this quote once that was very helpful to me, which was, and I wish I could tell you right off the top of my head, maybe Joan will remember, and somebody from ancient, you know, Roman times. And what he said was, what if life is that which we call death and death what we call life? So one of the questions I've had to ask myself is, what is going on the other side of the tapestry? Is it paradise? Is it beautiful? Is that where all of these people are? And if that's the case, you know, perhaps it lessens the feelings of tragedy that, you know, on the surface we may feel. You know, another piece of the answer I got when I went to the funeral of a very close friend's son, who had the whole world by the tail. I mean, he'd, you know, graduated from Georgetown, where he was a championship rower, and he'd gotten into the London School of Economics, and he'd met the love of his life, and, you know, he went on a vacation before showing up in London, and is killed by an errant truck driver who, you know, goes into his lane on a motorcycle. And by the way, his best friend was on the back of the motorcycle, who broke his ankle, and Scott dies at the scene. So I'm at the funeral, and the priest says, I don't want anyone here to think that this is God's will. This is not God's will. You know, he said, we who are left behind have to live with an unanswerable question. Why? And I know that's not a good answer, but that was the best answer that I had ever heard.
Right. I mean, if you look at the fact that John Walsh's son went missing and the end of his story was not where John Walsh wanted it to be. But in that instant, the work and the fire that was ignited in this man brought hundreds, if not thousands, of people to justice with America's Most Wanted and John Walsh Investigates and the other programs he's been a part of. And it's again, you can't even fathom the concept of losing a child, especially to something so heinous and horrible. But the miracle came afterwards. The miracle came in how many lives did John Walsh save from his own loss? And it's hard to sometimes see that perspective. But in living in honor of those people, making a difference going forward, that's where miracles lie, right? Is in what you might change going forward to make sure that somebody else doesn't live through this. And so that this death, this loss is not in vain. Putting forth that effort and positivity to do something to make the world a better place. That's a pretty powerful statement as well.
And that's where we call the ripple effect
right, of
a miracle. That is the ripple effect, the quintessential ripple effect, and that's where you find the miracle.
Yeah, and I was just going to, you know, touch on something that Tim had said when he talked about this lack of control, that we have no control. It's a humbling and terrifying feeling. Most of us have felt that at one time or another, or will. And it always reminds me, like when you were talking about John Walsh, these are the things, these are the cards that are off the table. We can't bring your child back, and we have no control over something that is so huge and so tragic. However, Joan mentioned the ripple effect, and I'm going to go back to being the miracle for someone else, which is also what I think John Walsh accomplished. And we like to say, you know, if you want a miracle, then be the miracle for someone else, because it beats waiting around for a thunderbolt from the sky.
No, I appreciate those insights. And I think it is important for people to recognize the ripple effect and our place in society. And I love your concept of don't wait around, be the miracle for somebody else. And you might find in those moments, right? Sometimes when I've been at my lowest by doing something for somebody else, it has lifted me. Selfishly, it has lifted mm-hmm. me out of the place I was at, and creating a miracle and again, I don't want to say that in a godly sense of it, but sometimes in helping just because it's the right thing to do and not looking for a pat on the back or accolades from it lifts you as well, and can help bring you to a new level by not giving in to the darkness, by not giving in to the selfish nature of our own poor me's.
Absolutely. I think that's right. And just to one more story, I was being interviewed the other day on a radio station about my story, and the host told his own harrowing story of a tragedy in his own family, a murder. And at the end of this story, he said, you know, grief and tragedy is something that can lead us down a path towards revenge and hate. And he said, I understood that. And I understood that I had to choose a different path, that I had to choose a path of forgiveness. And so that's his sort of whole thing in life, is that that's his miracle ultimately, was that he was able to find his way to forgiving this man who murdered his grandmother, and that is sort of his way of life also, that even for smaller slights, that he has to find a way to forgiveness.
That's beautiful. What a great concept on that as well, right? I mean, not giving in, but giving back and transcending those moments.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. Yep.
Very cool. Folks, we're in a time of need of miracles. We need to see the miracles. We need to find our own miracles. And this book is a first step for you to maybe take yourself out of the doldrums and the poor me's, and give you a chance to see the magic that occurs around us every day. The Miracle Collectors, Uncovering Stories of Wonder, Joy, and Mystery, is out and available. We have a link to our author's website and to this book on today's program guide. So please get the book, write and review the book, and help spread the word. Be a miracle worker for these two authors and get their book even more publicity by sharing and doing what you can to spread the word. There's enough bad news and negative news out there. Let's do something different and put people on a different path. You never know who might be changed and transformed from being able to read this book. Ladies, thank you so much for being a part of the show today and sharing some bright spots.
Oh, our pleasure. And thank you for your stories as well.
It's always
great. Thank you, Tim. Thank you, Dave.
It's always great to chat with you on talking about these kind of things. We'd love to talk more in the future, because I'm sure you're going to get a lot more stories. And maybe as the holidays do approach, we can revisit and share more stories of miracles. Would you be willing to come back and spend some time with us around Christmas?
We'd love to. Absolutely.
Perfect. That sounds great. And thank you all for listening. Thank you, Tim, for sharing your story. I know that was painful, but I hope that it'll touch other people the way it touched us and give people another insight into our world. And listen, you've got a long journey left ahead of you, brother. That's why you keep surviving these things that would have knocked down any other man. There's something important that you do, and you know, in bringing the show out and opening up and being human and sharing your story with others shows them that they're not alone. So we have a long journey left ahead of us, brother. Let's keep this next 15 years going before either one of us decides to give in and break down. How about that?
Sounds good. Either that or I'm just too dumb to quit.
There's that too. McDonald's, no pressure, but McRib is one of the things that keeps us both coming back every year. So yeah, make sure that you start bringing it back to Minnesota for us. Get the book, order it, look in the program guide today for more information. We will be back with more of the best in paranormal talk radio next week with brand new episodes. Make sure you tune in tonight to the live video stream on our Darkness Radio YouTube page and our Darkness Radio Facebook pages. Brand new live stream of Darkness Radio Presents tonight as we examine another episode of Holzer Files Season 1 and go back in time to check that out. So make sure that you tune in and watch that. For those of you that listen to the podcast, you'll get the audio version of that tomorrow right here on the best in paranormal talk radio. For Tim Dennis, I'm Dave Schrader. This is Darkness Radio.